You're listening to Elephant Talk. It's CHOY 101.7. My name is James Booker.
And I'm Julie Chadwick.
And we are now going to introduce you to our two guests for the morning.
And we have Francesca Allen. She's from the Lunatics Liberation Front, which, again, I love that name. She's an activist for the psychiatrically labeled. And we have Rob Wypond. He's a freelance writer who specializes in mental health issues. And I just wanted to maybe read a little excerpt from one of Rob's articles that he wrote for Monday.
Hi. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hi, guys. I just thought this article, For Your Own Good, there's a little intro in it that is really good. It's about the Victoria mental health professionals and the kinds of... I was quite shocked about the kinds of things that they were doing. It starts, they do not want you to know that your neighbors, teachers, and landlord can send the team after you, that the helpline may tip authorities to trace your number, that staff at the shelter to which you flee may help incarcerate you without trial. They don't want you to know because that might hurt their chances of helping you in your time of crisis. So if you read this article, goes the argument of some of Victoria's mental health professionals, Monday magazine will have done you a grave disservice. But ever since Frank Kingsley found out, he's been convinced everyone should know. As Kingsley tells it, his story began 3 nights after he was assaulted by his girlfriend's ex-lover. The investigating police officer appeared at his door escorting 2 plainclothed women. One began asking Kingsley questions. The other took notes. Are you suffering from stress, Mr. Kingsley? He recalls the woman asking. Do you take medication? Have you ever smoked marijuana? Kingsley said he answered casually, but when he was asked about his sex life and his relationship with his mother, he began to feel uncomfortable. What is today's date? Continued the woman. Kingsley wondered aloud why he was being asked such questions. The woman responded cryptically, Do you have a problem with it? Eventually, Kingsley was told the woman and her partner were mental health professionals. They were worried he might be suffering trauma from the assault. Sounds like they were worried. Kingsley says he thanks them.
Sounds like they gave him trauma.
Kingsley said he thanked them for their concern, but he was stunned by the questions that followed. What's the relationship between an apple and a banana? Asked the woman. What's the similarity between a canoe and a bicycle? I have to say, just jump in, I actually had a dream about a canoe and a bicycle after reading this last night. I started to get a really funny feeling that this wasn't quite right, Kingsley recalls now. It sounded like they were asking me questions to check on whether I was a nutcase or not, rather than worrying about me suffering from trauma and wanting to help me. Kingsley asked the police officer what was going on. The officer explained that his assailant had confessed, but asserted that Kingsley was dangerously mentally unstable. The two women were assessing Kingsley to decide whether he needed treatment. He was flabbergasted. A 53-year-old professional, he'd never been in contact with any mental health worker and had never before been involved in a physical altercation. Was this just another way for his assailant to lash out at him? The suggestion was greeted with silence. What does it mean that people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw rocks? Continued the woman. So weird. It's like you're walking on a razor's edge, explains Kingsley. Your normal reaction as a citizen or a human being is to get angry with this bullshit, to tell them to get the hell out of your apartment. But you're afraid to actually get angry because you're sure they'll use that against you. It's degrading, he continues. I felt intimidated and afraid. It was the fact that they could just come like that at any time, bang on your door, charge in, and possibly haul you away. 20 minutes after their arrival, the three stood to leave. They indicated that they'd check out some of Kingsley's answers. That was Kingsley's first, and so far his only, visit from a local emergency health response team. I was just amazed that this kind of stuff goes on. It's like sounds really scary to me.
Yeah, and it goes on like a lot. You know, they're a pretty busy team every day, every month. And of course, we like to think that the most cases they're dealing with people who are, you know, extremely in crisis and just need help, and they're just helping talk them down, and they do indeed do that. However, there's this whole other side, because mental health is so, you know, such a broad gray area where they're involved in situations where they might encounter you or I. I use another example later on in that article of if you're a victim of an assault or a sexual assault, just a robbery, Victoria Victim Services gets your name and number, and they'll come to your door. And if they decide that you're looking a little weird, a little traumatized or something, they may call an emergency mental health team to assess you. So very strange situations that are quite dangerous, really, because they're just expanding the reach and scope of the mental health system. And that's just one aspect. Of course, they're getting into our schools now much more and on and on.
And also the criteria for them to step in is just, I mean, we sort of like to think it's a person in crisis that's actually wanting help. But, you know, I've had visitors because I was having a nap on the front lawn once, and my neighbors thought that was kind of weird.
And you had mental health professionals coming?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And they said, well, you seem disoriented. And I'm like, oh, yeah, there's cops all over my street.
And I've been napping on the lawn.
Yeah, so you have to really, you have to be pretty careful these days.
That's unbelievable. I've had the same feeling before myself, like just sort of sitting on the side of the road waiting for someone to come pick me up and having cars go by and everyone staring at you, like as if sitting in a public space, not on a bench, is totally bizarre or something.
Well, it's very threatening behavior.
Wow, that's quite scary.
Yeah.
So something I just wanted to get into in the beginning is you've both been before the Canadian Senate Committee just recently. So can either of you tell me what that's about?
The Senate Committee on Social Affairs, blah, 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 they've got a longer name, they were doing a big study, cross-Canada study on the healthcare system. And while doing that, they identified that the mental health system was something that deserved attention in itself. A lot of people were raising issues around it. So they subsequently decided to do a full investigation. They've generated three reports so far and are in a massive sort of public consultation process, traveling around the country and having people come in and talk to them and field questions.
And so what did you guys go and say before this committee? Like what were you specifically talking about, or what concerns were you raising?
Well, I personally focused a lot on something I thought other people wouldn't, and that was I looked at two things. I looked at the language and arguments that were in their three reports, and kind of really criticized some sections of their reports to try to show them how biased they were. And I also looked a lot at the science of psychiatry, the way we examine people, the way we diagnose people, the way we decide whether or not to treat them against their wills. And I sort of took a critical approach to that, because I think that mainly they're going to be hearing from psychiatrists and people who are very pro forced treatment and things like that when they talk about the science. So I thought that I would, you know, that it might be unusual for them to hear a critical approach on the science. So that's what I did.
And I sort of went for a more personal angle. Like, I just talked about what it means to have a psychiatric label and how that impacts a person's life, and, you know, that maybe we shouldn't be so quick to do that, you know, based on the kind of things that get in motion afterwards.
And so are they actually really taking into account, like, things that people are saying to them, or is this kind of just lip service they're paying?
I don't know. I hope they're, you know, I mean, it was great that we were invited. I think that's very positive.
You're right. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
I think it remains to be seen, you know, what that will mean as far as their final report. And then again, what their final report will mean for the people that are in the system. So I think we've got, you know, a little ways to go yet before we can declare a victory.
What is the name of the Senate committee again, or the hearing?
It's they're just having hearings on the mental health system. It's the Senate Committee on Social Affairs
and Technology, I think.
Yeah, and technology, something. You know, it's just some weird sort of concatenation of different subjects that the Senate Committee supposedly addresses. So it's a subcommittee of the Senate. It was about, I guess, what, about 10 senators that were there. And our impression was that, you know, I came away... It basically encouraged that they seemed reasonably knowledgeable. They asked what I thought were intelligent, insightful questions. They seemed very interested overall in our perspectives and so forth. So from that perspective, I was very encouraged. You know, this kind of thing is very hard to suss out, though. They're politicians, and they know how to be diplomatic. And, you know, I'm not terribly optimistic about what that report, final report is going to say. But they definitely seem to indicate that they thought we were making reasonable points.
And do
you
know,
for the most part.
Yes.
Yeah.
There were a couple that clearly didn't like us.
Yeah.
do you know what what they're hoping to achieve with this? With this committee, with the subcommittee?
Well, they will basically, as I understand it, they have really no legal, you know, authority in the matter. They will simply make a final report and including recommendations that they will submit to Parliament. And I think there's some sort of, you know, protocol in Parliament that it will actually get discussed. Where it goes from there is anyone's guess. So really, it's just, I think I'm encouraged that this kind of discussion's going on. I think our society really needs to discuss the full range of issues around the mental health system a lot more, but it's also dangerous because, you know, in the past we've seen different issues get picked up, and sometimes when they get a lot of publicity, a lot of attention, it actually backfires and makes things worse, you know.
And I think things are certainly changing and impacting mental health of the society in general. Like, and I think a couple of the things that come to mind immediately are... if for some people, poverty really impacts mental health. For people that are, you know, have mental health issues, poverty is just another burden. And then there's also something that I think is fairly new or fairly recently come into the public vocabulary is the idea of dual diagnosis, where people are dealing with mental health and other issues, like typically drug addiction. So... I think those things are making it more difficult to deal with for a lot of people, for a lot of regular people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That we're it's very easy for people to be marginalized or to be feared or I don't know, misunderstood, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and something I wanted to ask you too about, based on what you're saying before the Senate committee is talking about, like Robbie, you're saying about the biased way in which. The science is, and also Francesca about the psychiatric labeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I, when you really even think about it a tiny bit, it's hard to say why exactly someone is labeled as sane or insane or fitting in or not. And it seems in many ways that it's kind of arbitrary as to how it is you're labeled, for example.
Completely arbitrary.
Yeah, like you could have, do you think that it, like, for example, being able to fit in to this economic system, that's one of the major, like, that you can be a contributing member of society, basically?
That's huge.
Yeah, I would say that's the dominant factor, and that's something that, you know, the psychiatric system seems to be in a bit of a denial about it, but for sure, the reality is this, right? It really doesn't matter what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what I'm going through. If I can get up, make myself a meal, go to my job, be reasonably, you know, accomplished at my job, or at least pick up my welfare check or whatever it is, if I can be reasonably functional so that I'm not disrupting other people's lives in a really dramatic way or any way at all, nobody's going to care. Nobody's going to pay any attention to me. It's all about when you start interfering somehow in someone else's way such that they don't like you. You're disrupting them, whether it's just you're running up and down the hallways at night, you know, or something as simple as that you're just behaving in a way that irritates them.
Sleeping on your lawn.
and that suddenly if you're less functional, you know, when you are less functional, they feel that they have not just a duty but almost like an obligation to help you, you know, because you're falling through the cracks. But the problem with that as a notion in a mental health thing is suddenly they're treating you, rather than just helping you because you're poor and giving you money and giving you supportive housing and things like that, like we might do with some other disability, in this case, they want to treat you with drugs, they want to electroshock you, they want to completely reframe your whole mindset. And that's where it becomes so, so shocking.
Oh, and they want you just to fall in line.
And if you have, for example, a person that's not fitting in, like, the big question I find is, what are they trying to make you fit in with? We had a girl on the show last week, and she wrote an article that was entitled, basically, Civilized Sanity is Impossible, because she was saying, you know, to try and fit in with this society, you basically have to shut your eyes to the people on the street asking for money. You have to ignore the fact that every time you flush a toilet, damage is being done. Every time you turn on a light... you know, the energy is being produced in destructive ways every time you turn on your car. Everything that you do, it's so hard to separate yourself from the destruction that's going on, and that in itself is a form of insanity.
To live in this to live in this world like a good capitalist consumer without thinking badly is insanity.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, a frequent example for people, and you know, Francesca can probably talk about this more eloquently than I. But you know, a frequent example, for example, I've heard is people saying, "I'm in the hospital, and I felt like I was being poisoned." You know, and the doctors are all saying, "Oh, well, that's part of your delusion, yada yada." Whereas I'm looking at the average food, you know, that is given in a hospital setting, the drinks, you know, the coffee, the this, that, and the other, and I'm going, "Well, most of it is poison." You know? And the drugs, of course, they're being given are usually super toxic. So they are being poisoned. So it may be, you know, some weird delusional feeling they're having, but it also may be that, in fact, they're just really sensitive.
Oh, and inpatient treatment for mental health clients is just appalling, just absolutely appalling.
Inpatient treatment?
Yes.
When you're, what is that, when you're...
Hospitalized.
Okay.
And how so?
Does it differ from non-psychiatric patients?
Completely.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, the biggest thing in every psych ward that I've ever been on, which is about four or five of them, I think, is that they want people to behave themselves. And when you are behaving, this kind of goes back to what Rob was saying about don't bother your neighbors, you know, if you want to get by in the society. But if you are being a good patient, which means not acting up, taking your meds when they tell you, basically just drooling in front of the television is what they want you to be doing, then you're praised for that. And if you say what they want to hear, then that's called insight. And, you know, there's all these...
Insight?
Insight. And
is
someone who
parroting,
says...
Parroting what they...
Yes, that's what the definition is. The real definition of insight is, and if you were to say, I mean, I'm happy to say that I was an extremely disruptive, horrible patient. They couldn't get rid of me fast enough. But that was, you know, the fact that I was so outraged that I had my civil liberties just trampled like this, that was actually used against me as a symptom of my illness, when in fact I don't see that it's illness at all. I think it's perfectly appropriate to say, you guys are... You know, you're treating me like a child. This is disgusting. Stop it. I mean, these are all things that healthy people would do.
Yeah, exactly. How do they deal with? I mean, the thing that jumps to my mind is, what if you have a person that is highly creative, musical or artistic, and or, you know, poetic or something? I mean, how would they deal with that kind of a person?
Well, there's certainly no outlet provided. I mean, hopefully a person like that would be able to continue to write. But, you know, I mean, if they're a writer, but of course the staff would be reading what they were writing and bringing it to the psychiatrist's attention if they said anything subversive in there. There was no music, no art therapy, no outside therapy. I mean, all the things that we know are good for people generally, but especially for people in an emotional crisis, none of those things were provided.
Yeah, there's a wonderful novel by a Victorian native, actually, Jodi Lundgren, called Touched. And it's her own personal story. It's mainly an autobiographical novel of, you know, she had gone through a lot of abuse in her childhood and then had a big crisis in when she was at university, here at the University of Victoria, and ended up in the psychiatric hospital and went through a lot of trauma. Well, it's really an amazing story to read, and one of the reasons is because in the end, she talks about how the writing, and she takes up dance and a very expressive form of therapeutic dance by the end of the novel, and really finds this to be incredibly, you know, helpful for her to get these energies out and explore them in ways that are sort of accepted by society, at least, right, that she doesn't cause more problems, and just, you know, really releases and moves, shifts energies around inside herself, and that's something that the mental health system never gave her. In fact, they were much more concerned with trying to stop those energies from emerging at all. They see them as threatening, dangerous, you know, unbelievable. And I have to say that, I mean, my experience with Francesca, again, probably has seen this. All the psychiatrists I've interviewed, the overwhelming, not all of them, but an overwhelming majority are amazingly square. rare people. That's what I, you know, I'm an artist, you know, I've been a performer, I'm into zany behavior, you know, I'm just like, and I don't think that's that unusual, but you know, I would just say these people are kind of like, if you put me as a 60s hippie child, they'd be the square uptight, you know, people from that era, and I really see that, and I think it's a dominant aspect. It's really whole cultural attitude difference there.
This is what's kind of quite amazing to me, is that, like, going back to this thing of, if you can economically fit in society, then, and you can keep going to your job, and like you said, don't upset the status quo and stuff, then you're fine. Because if you looked at probably even a lot of psychiatrists and, for example, a stockbroker, I had this friend that was a stockbroker in Vancouver, and he explained to me what he did in his job, and it just sounded totally crazy to me. Like, he'd go to his job, and he had 12 phones there that were all ringing off the hook, and he would just go from phone to phone to phone, yes, buy, sell, no, don't buy, sell, blah, like, just, and he said, like, the whole day he would just be shaking. It was like he was on speed the whole day, and as if you couldn't interview him and find that there's paranoid tendencies and obsessive tendencies and, you know, scared of what his boss thinks and, you know, like, way too over hyperactive and, like, but the thing is, he's making loads of money, so he's all right, isn't he? You know, he probably can't sleep at night because he's worrying about what's going to happen the next day at work. And
yeah, well, it is, and it's actually a common question they will ask when they're diagnosing is, okay, you have these problems. Is it interfering with your job? That is a really common diagnostic question.
Yeah,
that they'll
never
ask.
Mind, is your job interfering with your soul?
Yeah.
More meaningful questions such as that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like, if, do you have a mundane, boring job with a horrible boss where you have to go down and, you know, cut down forest every day and, you know, never question what you're doing?
Well, they don't. There's no room in psychiatry for that kind of real analysis. Like, I was very, very depressed at my job. I hated my job. And whenever I was on medical leave, and then I would schedule a return to work date, and then the night before, I would always attempt suicide because I really didn't want to go back.
Wow.
And I kept ending up in the hospital over and over again, and they kept saying, well, do you want to try shock treatment? Do you want to try this? Do you want to try that? And it was only when I was out of the system that actually a counselor, God bless her, said to her, you know, I'm thinking this might not be the job for you, you know, and to look at it like the approach, the whole thing, look at what's going on instead of let's medicate somebody so they can grin and bear it and make it through and survive.
Yeah.
And continue to pay taxes.
And it's kind of that bigger question of, does society serve us or do we serve society?
Well, yeah.
And it's that's a really good point you're making.
Well, and Francesca made an excellent point at the Senate committee, because someone asked us, you know, we both of us happened to be saying that we were, you know, really against a forced psychiatry and forced intervention. It was like one thing if somebody chooses of their own to say, hey, these medications help me in my opinion and I want to do them. Well, you know, fine. There's an argument to be made there that, all right, you know, you're free to do that. But when you're forcing it on someone, so anyway, they were really resistant to this. One in particular said, well, what are you going to do when somebody's suffering from mania and delusions? And Francesca was like, well, you know, like what? You know, because we kept saying, well, this was a common thing we kept finding. They would say mania and delusion. We'd go, well, for example, like hey, what sort of situation?
Yeah, a real concrete example.
Yeah. And so in the end, like she just kept saying, well, mania, delusions, mania, and delusions, and well, Francesca can probably tell you what sort of.
No, you go ahead.
Well, just you know, she was saying, well, okay, you know, some people believe that there is, you know, a person in the sky who looks down on us and watches everything we do. Are they delusional? Should we treat them against their will? You know, an example I used is, well, you know, we talk about you're a danger to yourself and you need to be incarcerated. Should people who smoke be incarcerated against their will? And treated with medications,
exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Like, and that was, but that was beyond them. They really had trouble. All of them, but some of them really had trouble kind of making that psychological leap to go,
really?
Okay, maybe my assumptions about society and what's normal and acceptable are questionable. You know, maybe someone would see me as crazy, you know, and maybe somebody reasonable would see me as crazy. They can't make that leap, whereas I find people on the other side can quite readily do it. They see their psychiatrist. The crazy crazy, but they're quite willing to say, okay, sometimes I'm crazy too, right? And that's sort of the difference. I rarely have met a psychiatrist who would say, yeah, I see that maybe I'm also crazy.
I've heard they're all squares.
Yeah, exactly.
But the thing as well is that the basic premise of the society we're living in is basically crazy, you know? And so when you look at the basis of, you know, for example, that we can endlessly extract resources and never somehow have to, you know, we can always extract more and more and more of a finite thing and it'll never go away. Like, come on, that's just impossible, right?
I think our society is really sick. You know, I think that the things that we value are really, really misguided. And I think actually part of the reason for the kind of an epidemic of people dropping out and just kind of saying, well, that's just not going to work for me, is a problem with society, not with the people that we choose to call mentally ill.
Oh, I totally agree.
And a sane reaction, you know? Like, I think it's a fairly sane reaction that if you hate your job that much and it's that soul-destroying for you that, you know, you would rather do anything than go back to it. I think that's a pretty sane reaction, you know?
Yeah. Since I've criticized psychiatrists a lot, I'll talk about my favorite psychiatrist here for a sec, is a guy named Dr. Stanislav Grof, and he has a whole different theory of what sort of so-called mental illness is. He would call it a spiritual emergency, you know, that these crises that seem to be becoming more common in our society are just that. It's like your own inner psyche, your own inner being trying to push you to a crisis point. It's trying to make you quit your job. It's trying to make you change your life. You know, that energy is emerging from within, and yes, when it first comes up, it seems very disruptive. It seems dangerous. You're afraid of it. You know, all kinds of strange things can happen, but, you know, his whole model of the psyche is to encourage and support this kind of thing, not as, like, bad crisis, but as positive spiritual breakthrough on, you know, coming up, and let's support it. Let's provide a space for it to occur and let someone explore that energy and see where it leads them, see how they change their lives as a result of that crisis.
Yeah.
And that's an opportunity.
Oh,
sorry.
No, go ahead.
That's an opportunity, like, to check it out, like, to see what your soul is telling you and, you know, like, to examine what it is, like, for instance, that I hated about my job. That those kind of opportunities to change your life in really profound ways for the better, that is completely denied by mainstream psychiatry. If you go that route where you're just kind of medicated into submission, you're denying yourself a fabulous opportunity, and I think that's a terrible shame.
I agree. My uncle who lives in England worked for, like, similar to what Julie was describing. He worked in England's Wall Street, which is Threadneedle Street, and he also worked on Wall Street. And he was trading metals and stuff like that. And he had absolutely no life outside of the stock market. He never saw his wife and kids. He was he would come home very late at night, and he started smoking at the age of 40, which I always think is a bad sign. You know, if you do it when you're 16 because of peer pressure, well, you know, I can understand that. But take it up at 40, then you've got to examine your life a bit. And he also started drinking. And then one day he came home and he said, I've quit my job. I want to go to Australia and buy a sheep farm. And everybody in my family except me thought he had lost it. And I screamed, like, you know, against the madness, like, no, he's finally found it. Like, are you kidding? What a horrible life he's had. What a terrible career, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, would anybody want to be in his shoes and do his job? So a year later, he didn't go to Australia. I guess he compromised a little, but now he's a postman. And he gets up early every morning and gets the kids ready for school and goes out and walks around the English countryside and delivers letters.
Oh, good for
and
him.
I think
he's
infinitely happier.
The
thing that really troubles me is that the amount of people that were saying, like, oh, something's really gone wrong, you know, and he's lost it. And I couldn't understand it. These are what I thought are reasonable people, you know.
Yeah, so
even though they're my family members.
Well,
we have a terrible fear in our culture of going crazy and of doing even anything particularly radical in our lives, right? We get very attached to cozy jobs and, you know, nice situations, and as a result, when these kinds of things start emerging, it's we ourselves often have a very frightened reaction to them, but definitely the people around us who if they aren't radical, creative people themselves, right, they can't understand it. It's like the stern father with the son that wants to be a rock musician, right? What do you think, son? Get your life together, right? But it might work out for him, or if nothing else, he might really just have a good time, you know, exploring that side of himself.
And it's amazing what the definition of doing something radical in your life is now. Like, if you want to quit your horrible, soul-destroying, dead-end job and do something more fun, like be a sheep farmer or whatever, that's seen as radical and weird, but yeah. Really it's kind of like, which is the more sustainable lifestyle here, you know? Or if you want to just, you know, go, you have dreams about going off and swimming naked in the lake or something, it's seen as like, oh, like some people would think that that's a bit weird rather than wanting to go to the mall or something. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how far we've gone with redefining what's normal. And I think as well the point you made, Francesca, about Stanislav Grof and the crisis as opportunity. I've used this example before, but I was just imagining how there's this whole story about how a caterpillar becomes a butterfly, and how at a certain point when it's about to become a butterfly, its whole system goes into crisis, and it if you were to analyze it at that point, it would seem like it was going to die because all of its systems are failing, and then it makes this jump and it becomes something else, right? And I was imagining, like, when you're saying that, a psychiatric person coming along and saying, no, you must stay a caterpillar. We've got to, you know, we've got to prop up all these systems and keep you as a caterpillar because you're dying and everything's going wrong.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent
yes,
little analogy,
is.
Metaphor
it
thing.
Certainly,
yeah.
Is.
Yeah.
It's strange as well how really, like, in 2,000 years, our view of mental illness or whatever you want to call it hasn't really changed. We've sort of changed what we call it. Like, I think in the if you look back in the Bible, they used to think that people were possessed of demons, uh-huh, and needed to be exorcised. And now we'll often call the same people... We'll give them a different psychiatric label, and we think we've come so far, but really we're treating them the same way.
Oh, they're
not, for all intents and purposes, they're sort of shunned by the community and whatever, and we're giving them some bizarre treatment. It used to be, I guess, holy water and an exorcism, and now it's some...
we've moved on.
Yeah.
Now we just shock them and drug them.
Well, an interesting aspect of that...
I prefer the holy water myself.
Right. An interesting aspect of that is you know... Michel Foucault has a wonderful little book, The Madness and Civilization, right, where he kind of looks at some of these issues, and one of them is to show how much the whole notion, though, of insanity as a fairly modern idea itself. Like, in the old days, it was more like you were the town weirdo, you know, you had some place in society in a slightly different fashion, but this whole notion of, you know, of insanity itself is very much has come about as societies, as the dominant societies become one which is extremely structured, as indeed ours is. You know, in the olden days, societies were much less rigidified in because they were traveling, you know, nomadic or very. I mean, you can different societies through different times, obviously. But this is the general argument he makes: is that the increasing as you increase rigidification in society, you increase the range and numbers of people that you will call crazy.
Uh-huh.
That's a really good point. And also, I think in the past, the technology wasn't there to foist those ideas upon everyone. You know, you could have all these pockets out in the wilderness all over the place, and maybe there wasn't even really roads reaching them, so they could go off and do whatever they wanted and escape that rigidification.
Well, yeah, and an interesting sort of analogy of that is to look at some of the energies that say are commonly occur in people who are in psychological crisis, and ask yourself, how might that particular energy have played out in a totally different society?
Oh, yeah.
And a great, I think there's one, Providence Farm, I think it's called, Up Your Way, right? Where they have in the past, at least I'm not sure what their status is, so I don't want to speak definitively on it, but in the past there's been an outdoor farm up there that allowed people with different kinds of mental difficulties to spend time outdoors just working, basically, in a supportive environment. And it was extremely successful, you know, and it's just, when you you go to an average psychiatric hospital, you can see why they're so unsuccessful. It's just like, it's just this dim, dreary prison, really, to live in. And there's so little there for you. And you know, often when I've gone there, I've just thought, oh, for God's sakes, this person would be so much better if they were just sitting outside all day as opposed to inside, you know?
Indeed.
Get away from that TV set, for crying out loud.
I actually am currently working at Providence Park.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, and yeah, it's still going. There's a lot of participants there. I think there's an average of about 60, and it's a totally amazing place. There's people with all range of disabilities or whatever, from physical disabilities to something like Down syndrome, or somebody who's depressed or has schizophrenia or just has some type of undefined psychiatric problem or depression or whatever. And yeah, the whole premise of the place is basically that that horticulture and gardening and being outdoors is in itself therapeutic, and that by bringing people together and working on the farm together and making it first a priority that people are taken care of and know how to operate in a community, that is going to be their therapy. And I find it amazing. There's, you know, like I said, there's people with all kinds of different things going on, and I never feel a sense of danger, or it's threatening, or it's weird, or people are being funny. In fact, you can't even tell most of the time who is the participant and who is the client person and who's the coordinator and who's the person, you know what I mean? Like, who's the sane one and who's the insane one or something?
You can certainly tell on the psych ward, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
It's totally mixed up, though. It's absolutely amazing, you know, because, like, when I first got there as well, I was having, you know, like a girl with Down syndrome was teaching me how to do stuff and teaching me how to do the transplants and everything. And so it's very mixed up and very non-hierarchical there, which is also quite amazing.
Mm. So, yeah, that's tremendous. That's tremendous. And I got to say, I've seen that so often when people are freaking out, whether they're my friends or people that I've interviewed or whoever. It's often the case that you're spending too much time in your own little internal world, and you're getting increasingly disconnected from other people, from nature, from all these things, right? And and that I find it's very hard to go crazy outside.
Really, yeah.
I think that alone. You're just so overwhelmed by nature a lot. It's a whole different energy force, really.
Mm.
And we've become so insensitive to that, but you know, in our society. But I think it's really, really a dominant energy.
I think we really need to relax our, certainly the boundaries we put on the mind. You know, we're not allowed to explore anything but the very rigid sort of 9-to-5 rat race. Look at how much things like psychedelic experiences, for instance, are so shunned and illegal and, you know.
Generally frowned upon.
Yeah, dangerous. And where you listen to someone like Terence McKenna speak about those kind of experiences, and he believes that they're essential to human existence, at least to explore another, an alternative sort of path or another way of thinking or viewing reality. And I think that, you know, we really need to start doing that if we're going to save ourselves as a race.
Well, in my opinion, I think our society is just hysterical over the drug menace. And it just seems hypocritical and bizarre to me that you know, you can, the kind of criminal penalties that you will be subjected to, you know, for one type of drug, whereas they will practically, you know, just load you up with another type of drug, which, and many of these drugs are, it's a very, very kind of gray area, like when you're talking about an amphetamine as opposed to, like, Ritalin. You know, I mean, they're very, very similar chemical structure, and it's all, I mean, the defining criteria seems to be who's making the money on it, not whether this drug is dangerous, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah. And another interesting aspect of that is, you know, as you guys obviously know, you know, back in the 1960s, psychedelic research was a very important component of psychiatric research at that time. And it seems quite interesting to me to just make note of the fact that the dominant psychiatric drugs that are used today are tranquilizing and sedating drugs, to dull your senses, to you know, slow you down, to slow your thoughts down and all of that, whereas the psychedelics, which, you know, had, were subsequently illegalized and sort of thrown out by mainstream psychiatry, you know, are, do the exact opposite, right? They tend to heighten sensitivity. They tend to increase thought processes, you know, all those things. So I just think it's a great example of what modern psychiatry today, mainstream psychiatry, has come to be about. It's come to be about slowing, repressing, controlling, rather than unleashing and freeing.
Well, they want their patients easy to handle. Yeah. They want them, you know, placid, just especially in the hospital, but also as outpatients too. They don't want them questioning. My doctor didn't like it when I came and said things like, you know, I think you're full of shit, and I don't think you know anything. Yeah. You know, they don't like that kind of patient. They're looking for somebody.
That's not considered insight.
That's right. But in fact, it turned out I was very, very correct on that.
I would think that is total insight myself.
And the thing is, like, I think it's so unfair as well to have people perhaps that are, maybe they're having these problems because they've been taught not to trust what they think. And maybe as a child they were told, like, oh, you don't know anything, and, you know, you have all the problems, and what you believe is totally invalid, and all this kind of stuff. And then later, you know, they're having some very real questions about things, questions about society or whatever, which is a very important transition part in the person's life. And there's no help offered. It's just kind of like, again, when you go into the psychiatric system, it's like, nope, there's no validity to that. You're just, you know, you're just crazy and whatever. I think for me personally, and this is just getting to something I wanted to just wrap up with, is what is a good way for people to be able to cope with things? I found for me, if I had as a teenager, if I had parents that would have said to me, oh, you know, this stage you're going through where you're questioning everything and you think society's a load of crap and whatever, you know, that you don't want to be a CEO like your dad or whatever, oh, that's crazy, you should go see a psychiatrist and whatever. And if at that point people had told me, you're crazy, you have a problem, you need to go on psychiatric drugs, I probably would have had a problem to this day. It's only because my parents allowed me to go through that and encouraged it and encouraged me to ask questions and stuff that I managed to get to this point. And I think what keeps me sane personally is being able to make it a huge part of my life to question and criticize and sort of combat the system that we're living in, because I know, I feel like that's the right thing to do, you know, and that's the right place to put my energy. And of course, like, I don't imagine they do this in mental hospitals, but I really think that people that have mental problems should be encouraged to do that, to have what they're thinking validified, first of all, because I think that calms people down to have, you know, okay, like, what you're feeling, maybe I don't see the voices in your head or I don't hear them, but, like, I do validate the fact that you're hearing them.
Or just be listened to.
Yeah.
That's one thing that the patients really, really need, is they need to be listened to and taken seriously.
And I think that, I mean, let's face it, everybody has a monologue going in their head, you know, of things that, of you know, a type of hearing voices, if we want to talk about that. It's, mm-hmm. you know, and or strange impulses, or, you know, I mean, I can't take a dozen eggs out of the fridge without rearranging them so that they balance properly in the package.
They got meds for that, you know.
Yeah, I know they do. And so I was, my doctor once tried to put me on them, and I said, like, no, it doesn't matter. You know, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
You know, oh, it's an obsessive compulsive disorder. And I said, yeah, but it really tidies up the egg carton.
Yeah. The example I always like to use is, you know, the Canadian Mental Health Association has put out this handbook that's gone into all the high schools across the country. And it's, you know, how to notice if the student next to you needs to see a psychiatrist or something.
My God.
And a lot of it has to do, you know, some of the more extreme examples are, of course, the constant, if they have suicidal feelings or homicidal feelings. And I always think, yeah, well, if kids weren't allowed to experience suicidal and homicidal feelings, which is different than actually acting them out, right? We're talking about talking about them, thinking about them. If you weren't allowed to do that, where would Shakespeare be, right? Where would Dostoevsky be? Where would all of our great art be if those people had not been allowed to, in their own minds at least, you know, explore and express these feelings?
Yeah, no kidding. Like, did you say Dostoevsky?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, I'm surprised he didn't get locked up for, what was it, Crime and Punishment?
Exactly. In fact, I used that example with someone I knew who was feeling suicidal and homicidal and was feeling terrible. He thought, just having these feelings, even though I could tell there's no way this guy's actually going to do this, I could just feel it, you know? I wasn't afraid of him at all. I said to him, you know, well, think about it, because I knew he liked that book. And I said, think about that book and think about how much that author would have had to have sat around, like you are, thinking about those feelings to write such a compelling piece of art about those kinds of feelings. And it really changed his mind. It really helped him deal with it. You know, and to this day, he talks about that moment of realization he had when he suddenly thought, hey, maybe I'm not insane merely for having these feelings.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we're going to have to wrap up. We are completely out of time, but it's been really great to talk to you both.
Yeah.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.